Good morning. I'd like to go ahead and call the meeting of March 20th as Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 9 a.m. With us today is Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, Senator Elton, Senator Thomas, Senator Dyson. Today we're going to continue our discussion on the public employees retirement system. We're going to work on Senate Bill 123, which is a technical and clarifying reversions of the major retirement legislation reform, Senate Bill 141, that came forward a couple years ago. We'll work on that today. We're going to double back starting tomorrow morning and work on Senate Bill 125, which is the cost share bill that we worked on yesterday. So this will allow us time to have this bill, Senate Bill 123, the technical and clarifying language, have a presentation from the administration, get it on the table, so then our staffs can be reviewing this and looking at it along with or during the same time we work on the other bill. In their packets, everybody's packet today, there should be a PowerPoint presentation which will be presented here and the sectional analysis of 123. We're not going to be taking public testimony today. That'll come in probably a couple of days, maybe Thursday, depending on how our schedule rolls out. But we will have public testimony the next time this bill is at the committee. Today with us we have Commissioner Annette Kreitzer, Commissioner of Administration. She's in person. In living color, along with her, we have Kathy Lee, the retirement manager for the Division of Retirement Benefits, and Melanie Milhorn, which has been here numerous times, helping us work through these issues. With that, I'd like to go ahead and have the commissioner come forward, and I'll go ahead and turn the presentation over to you, if you can go ahead and introduce yourself and go ahead and take control of the floor.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I am once again before you, Annette Kreitzer, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Administration. I just want to point out a couple of differences between Senate Bill 123 that you have before you and House Bill 475, which you saw in the 24th Legislature. The two large differences that you'll see in the reason this bill is a little larger than the one you saw last year are the addition of issues that are in the Federal Pension Protection Act and additional Internal Revenue Code issues that have been identified by our tax counsel. The defined contribution plan received its favorable plan determination letters in February. And so, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to keep my comments very brief, just point that out, and Retirement Manager Kathy Lee is going to walk us through the bill. And as she comes forward, I'll just say that Senate Bill 123 also makes some technical corrections to the defined contribution plan the legislature intended to capture in Senate Bill 141. For instance, clarifying that death and disability benefits are to be provided to peace officers and firefighters and other members. And this bill, Senate Bill 123, makes that very clear. With that, if I could turn it over to Kathy Lee.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Kathy Lee. I'm the retirement manager for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Thank you for the opportunity this morning to present this overview of the technical correction bill. This overview is intended to cover the highlights of the bill with a more detailed and in-depth explanation contained in the sectional analysis. Senate Bill 123 is being introduced by Governor Palin and contains many of the provisions that were found in last session's House Bill 475, with some additions. Through the adoption of emergency regulations, the PERS and TERS defined benefit contribution retirement plans received their favorable plan determination letters from the IRS on the individual accounts and the occupational death and disability benefits. After incorporating the plan determination and the new federal requirements for government pension plans, Senate Bill 123 was created. This bill has been extensively reviewed for legal, tax, and administrative compliance by the Department of Law, the Division's Independent Tax Counsel, Ice Miller, and the Division of Retirement and Benefits. The purpose of this legislation is to ensure that the benefits of the defined contribution retirement plans as provided are provided as intended by the legislature. It updates the provisions of the defined benefit plans for compliance with the Federal Pension Protection Act of 2006. One of the provisions of this act requires previously qualified government plans to apply for requalification every 5 years. The division will be submitting applications for requalification of the defined benefit plans in 2008. The bill also amends or adds sections to provide for the appropriate administration of the plans. I have grouped the changes contained in this bill into three major areas. The first of which are changes to the PERS, TERS, defined contribution, or DCR plans. In summary, these changes include the administration and funding of occupational death and disability benefits, how employers participate or terminate participation in the DCR plans, clarification of who is a member of the DCR plan, and changes to provide intended benefits while meeting the Internal Revenue Code contribution limits. SB 141 provided occupational death and disability benefits for both the PERS and TERS DCR plans. However, funding of the TERS occupational death and disability was omitted. This bill provides that funding. Senate Bill 123 also clarifies benefits provided to disabled peace officers and firefighters when they reach normal retirement. And it adds a yearly cost of living adjustment to the DCR disability and survivor benefits that are similar to the Tier 3 PERS and Tier 2 TERS to meet the legislature's intent. Disabilitants would receive 75% of the increase in the Consumer Price Index based in the Anchorage area, or 9%, whichever is less. Survivor benefit recipients would receive 50% of that increase, or 6%, whichever is less. Senate Bill 141 is ambiguous regarding how the service accruals during a period of disability or receipt of monthly survivor benefits are to be treated. This bill clarifies that these periods can be used to meet service requirements for retirement, medical eligibility, and the medical premium cost share at normal retirement. Both disability and survivor benefits cease when the member reaches or would have reached normal retirement eligibility. The legislature intended to provide retirement benefits to the disabled member or to the survivor at that time. To meet that intent, Senate Bill 141 required continuing contributions to be made to the individual account while the member is on disability or while survivor benefits were paid. This bill clarifies that while the member is receiving disability benefits or survivor benefits, they are not entitled to withdraw the individual account balance. Also clarified is that a disabled member who reaches normal retirement eligibility by service is eligible to have a percentage of their medical premiums paid by the plan based on their total service under the plan's medical cost share provision, regardless of age. Other technical corrections include clarification that a member will not be considered disabled if they can perform the duties of a comparable job for any employer. The bill adds provisions for new employers to join or existing employers to terminate from the DCR plan. SB 141 provided employers with an opportunity to allow their non-vested employees to elect to convert from the defined benefit plan to the defined contribution plan. This bill limits the employee election period to 12 months from the date the administrator approves the employer resolution to participate in the conversion option. Placing a time limit on the employee election helps employers estimate and budget for the required matching employer contributions. Senate Bill 123 also creates a new health trust. The DCR statutes are being amended to direct the retiree health contributions to this new trust. The bill also establishes uniform contribution amounts for all employers participating in the health reimbursement arrangement. The definition of member in the PERS DCR plan includes employees, but does not include elected official. This bill adds elected state officials as members of the DCR plan and adds the governor, lieutenant governor, and legislators as members. New members joining after July 1, 2006, new employers joining after July 1, 2006 only join the DCR plan as the defined benefit plan is closed. Because a member of the DCR plan is defined as an employee who first enters the PERS on or after July 1, 2006, or a non-vested DB employee who has elected to convert, this called into question the status of a defined benefit employee who hires with a DCR-only employer. This bill clarifies that the DB member will participate in the DCR plan. Without this change, the employee could not participate in either plan. Senate Bill 141 repealed the statutes allowing members to reinstate refunded service in order to become eligible for retirement benefits. The status of former DB members who do not reinstate their refunded service and contributions to the DB plan prior to July 1, 2010 was left in question. Senate Bill 123 clarifies that former members will be DCR plan members upon reemployment after that deadline. Senate Bill 141 specified that employers of non-vested DB members who elect to convert to the DCR plan must match the employee contribution account 100%. However, limitations are placed on the amount of pre-tax contributions that can be deposited into an individual account during a tax year. That limit is the amount of total compensation, or $45,000, whichever is lower, for 2007, and it includes all pre-tax contributions from any qualified plan that the employer offers to the employee. In order to meet the legislature's intent for 100% employer match and to comply with the IRC, this bill allows the remainder of that account match to be paid in the following tax year, subject to the 415C limits. The legislation also clarifies that the service time converted from the defined benefit plan to the defined contribution plan can be used towards vesting and eligibility for retiring medical benefits. Senate Bill 141 stipulated that the employer continue to deposit employer and employee contributions to a disabled member's individual account while the member is receiving occupational disability benefits. This provision is permissible by the Internal Revenue Code only if the contributions are non-forfeitable. This bill adds this change to comply with this requirement. SB 141 also required the employer to continue to make both employer and employee contributions to a deceased member's account in order to provide a DCR benefit to the survivor at the time the monthly survivor benefit ceased. The Internal Revenue Code does not allow for pre-tax contributions to be made to a deceased member's account past December 31st in the year in which the member dies. This bill provides a tax-qualified mechanism to provide the benefit as the legislature intended. Required contributions will be paid to the Occupational Death and Disability Fund. Benefits paid from the account to the survivor at the time the member would have reached normal retirement, had the member lived, will equal the amount of contributions the member would have made and the employer would have made, plus any earnings experienced by the Occupational Disability and Death Fund. Also, to comply with the Internal Revenue Code, the DCR plans have added the provision for the Uniformed Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act, which ensures that members called to active military duty maintain their level of retirement benefits as though they had not been called. The DCR plans are currently administered in compliance with USERRA. However, this added language is necessary to retain plan compliance. The sections referring to contributions to a deceased member's individual account are removed, as well as the sections allowing voluntary employee pre-tax contributions to the plan based on advice from the division's tax council. Because the IRC restrictions on contributions of this type make the election and the amount of contribution irrevocable as long as an individual works for any PERS-covered employer, this provision is unappealing when compared with other more flexible plans afforded by the employer, such as a defined contribution or a deferred compensation plan. For this reason, Senate Bill 123 removes this provision. The second major focus area of this bill are changes to the defined benefit or DB plans. These include changes to the public employees, teachers, and judicial retirement plans. The Pension Protection Act, which became effective in August of 2006, expanded the type of plans eligible for rollover into the defined benefit plans for purchasing service or for rollovers of contributions out of the plans. Now, any IRA described in Chapter 26 of the United States Code is eligible for rollover. On January 1, 2008, this will also include a Roth IRA. Members electing to roll over pre-tax dollars to a Roth IRA, however, will be subject to taxation at that time. In the event of a divorce and a request to refund the member's defined benefit account balance, a former spouse or alternate payee who has had a qualified domestic relations order filed and accepted by the division that provides that alternate payee with a portion of the account may now roll over contributions to a qualified plan. Prior to this change, they could not. Senate Bill 123 also codifies the requirement for a plan accepting a rollover containing pre- and post-tax contributions to separately account for them. The bill also clarifies that the 415C limits apply to employee post-tax contributions and benefit payments in compliance with the new Pension Protection Act provisions. Changes to employer participation in the DB plan include redefining the normal cost and past service rate so that the rate can be applied to the total employer payroll, defined benefit, and defined contribution. This does not change the amount the employer will have to pay to the defined benefit plans for current and past service costs. It simply reduces the rate and increases the salary base the rate applies to. It also provides a salary base to apply the past service rate to for employers who no longer have active DB employees. It also requires that employers terminating participation in the plan must pay for the actuarial study to determine their termination costs and to pay the termination cost either in a lump sum or enter into a payment plan with the division within 60 days of their termination date. The PERS or TERS will be allowed to intercept other state funds held for an employer by state agencies or other political subdivisions when contributions are not paid, as long as those funds are not restricted by statute or appropriated for a specific purpose. It also codifies the uses of forfeitures. Forfeitures occur when a defined benefit member terminates employment and elects to refund their own contributions. The employer contributions made on behalf of that employee remain in the employer's assets and are used to pay benefits for the members who remain in the plan. Senate Bill 141 removed the member's ability to reinstate forfeited service effective July 1st, 2010. However, similar provisions to the reinstatement provisions for conditional service or a public service benefit were omitted. This bill conforms the conditional service and public service benefits in the PERS and TERS defined benefit plans to the repeal of the reinstatement statutes. It also clarifies that defined benefit members who hire with a DCR-only employer or a former defined benefit member who did not reinstate before July 1st, 2010, will participate as a DCR member. Without these amendments, these members would not be able to participate in either plan. The last focus area in this overview are the administrative changes to the plan. In order to separately account for retiree medical benefits, a new retiree health trust, separate from the pension trust, is created. This trust will be an Internal Revenue Code irrevocable Section 115 trust, with the Alaska Retirement Management Board as its trustees and the Commissioner of Administration or the Commissioner's designee as its administrator. Although the National Education Association was included in both the PERS and TERS as an eligible employer, NEA is a private nonprofit and is not eligible to participate in a government retirement plan. The division, the Department of Law, and NEA came to an agreement in the early 1990s that NEA would not enroll any new employees in either PERS or TERS. Members participating at that time were grandfathered into the systems. Currently, NEA has no active employees in either plan. The Social Security tax wage base cap for 2007 is $97,500, which means that no employee or employer contributions for the DCR plan members can be accepted for the remainder of the year once that wage cap is reached. The wage cap limit is not required for qualification of the plans and acts as a detriment in this plan. This bill eliminates that cap. It also conforms the administrator's duties as changed by Senate Bill 141 across the PERS, TERS, DB, and DC plans, the supplemental benefit system plans, the deferred compensation plan, and the health reimbursement arrangement. The last set of administrative changes are to correct omissions or drafting errors to Senate Bill 141 regarding regulations and appeals. Part of the reform of the retirement systems was a change in the regulation authority from the prior Public Employees Retirement Board and the Teachers Retirement Board. The reference to the PERS Board in the Supplemental Benefit System statutes pertaining to the authority for adoption of regulations was inadvertently changed to the ARM Board, along with many other reference changes. SBS regulations, like PERS regulations, relate to the administrative matters and should be adopted by the Commissioner. This change returns the regulation adoption authority to the Commissioner of Administration. Senate Bill 141 changed the appeal authority from the former PERS and TERS boards to the Office of Administrative Hearings. It did so for PERS and TERS, but inadvertently omitted transfer of that appeal authority for the Supplemental Benefit System Deferred Compensation Plan, or to provide for appeal authority for the health reimbursement arrangement. Without this change, appeals of decisions of the administrator would have to go directly to Superior Court. Members of both the PERS and TERS may appeal an adjustment to their benefits to the Commissioner of Administration. TERS DCR statutes allow an appeal of the Commissioner's decision to go to the Office of Administrative Hearings. However, the PERS statutes do not. This section of the bill corrects that drafting error. So in summary, the technical clarification bill allows the state to administer the benefits as intended by the legislature for the DCR plans, provides funding mechanisms for all benefits provided, addresses the Internal Revenue Code requirements, and removes any administrative ambiguity. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. Do we have any comments from the commissioner before we open up for questions? Seeing the enthusiasm from my committee members for questions, I'll go ahead and start. I recognize it's a rather dry subject matter, and this is one of the things we had to work with. On slide 10, talk about the reinstatement date of July 2010, members that are have previous service in a defined benefit plan coming back in and then being tripped into the defined contribution plan. How does the health care benefit change? Was a major or probably the major cost saving issue in this rewrite. How does that, or how is that handled?
Well, currently, through Mr. Chair, the member that comes back and reinstates service can vest and become eligible for a health benefit. As of July 1st, 2010, if they have not reinstated their service prior to that, they lose their tier and they lose that health plan. When they come back into employment with the PERS after that date, they will be DCR members and their health benefits will be based under the DCR plan. And because the health benefits are different between the plans, and the DCR plan has their health benefits designed as a cost savings measure, we will see lower health costs for that employee.
And the change, if I remember correctly, is from separation of service to age 65.
That's correct.
Could you, want to elaborate a little bit on that just to refresh people's memories on how the...
Well, under the defined benefit plans, a member can become eligible for system paid medical benefits at, if they're tier one, at age 50, or if they're tier three at age 60 with 10 years of service. Under this plan, the greatest amount of the cost for the health benefits comes between that time and when the member is Medicare eligible. The DCR plan requires that the member be Medicare eligible before they can qualify for the medical benefits. So it eliminates that high cost period of time that the DB member could participate in the medical plan.
Okay. On that point, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Hall.
On that point, Mr. Chairman, the window that you're talking about for reinstatement is from July 1 of 06 to July 1 of 2000.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that's correct.
Mr. Chair, on that point also.
Yes, go ahead. Are you done, Senator Hall?
Yes.
Central.
Thanks, and Kathy. Typically, and I'm going to outline a situation that could happen. You might have a person who was a tier one or tier two employee is rehired in 2011. When an employee leaves state service as a tier one or tier two, for example, they might cash out. And when they come back into service, they have to rebuy that time. Am I right so far?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So when a person who was a tier one or tier two cashes out, they cash out based on being tier one or tier two. When they, if they come back in at 2011, what do they buy back? Do they buy back based on a defined contribution, or do they buy back based on the plan that they cashed out of?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, if they return after the July 1st, 2010 date, they don't buy back anything. They have forfeited their tier, and they start fresh in the DCR plan.
So that the time they accrued, let's say they had 4 years in as a state employee in the 1990s, so those years don't count, they can't buy back and count those to vesting in a defined contribution, to being vested in a defined contribution plan?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, that's correct, because they did not reinstate their DB rights before July 1st, 2010. So they forfeit their tier and they forfeit the accumulated service.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell us a little bit about the new
Alaska Retiree Health Trust, what that really means to us?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, the new Retiree Health Trust will be a Section 115 health trust. This type of health trust provides pre-tax contributions and benefits for the medical plans as we have now. It also provides some flexibility for the employer that's not found in other types of qualified plans. The division, given some of the accounting concerns that we have had over the last year, felt it would be prudent to establish a health trust account separate from the pension trusts.
Thank you. And the provision to roll over Roth IRAs, I assume, applies to regular IRAs in addition?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, yes, it does. It just adds a Roth IRA as an additional option as of July 1st, 2008.
Right, and I noticed you made a special mention of the NEA and the fact that they're not an eligible employer. If you ask NEA about that, would they be happy or disgruntled or jury still out?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I believe that they accept this distinction because there was an agreement and a discussion with them in the 1990s regarding their status as an eligible employer, and this agreement was reached in conjunction with NEA.
Okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go ahead, Senator Robbins.
There's under administrative, there's a specific mention of Social Security tax. Could you just review with us quickly who is and who is not in the state covered by Social Security?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, currently the state of Alaska employees, and we have 14 other political subdivisions that participate in our supplemental benefits annuity program. They are not in Social Security. They use the SBSAP as their Social Security replacement. The other PERS employers are in Social Security, or they use PERS as their Social Security substitute. Teachers in Alaska do not participate in Social Security at all, so all of our teachers are not in Social Security at this time.
Okay, and the workforce, generally speaking, is pleased with that or concerned or not worried about it?
Through the chair, we haven't heard any concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. Senator Allen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Kathy, I'm on page 9, slide 9. And as we went through that, something occurred to me, and I'm going to outline a situation. You can tell me what does happen. Let's assume that one of the PERS employers decides to terminate from PERS, and let's further assume. Yesterday we went through a list of winners and losers. Let's assume that it's one of the small communities that is only obligated to pay the normal cost rate, 14.48. Could that PERS employer terminate from the system and then rejoin the system, thereby changing their employees, or maybe just an employer or one employee? Could they terminate from the system, then rejoin the system as a PERS employer again, and force the conversion of that employee to a defined contribution? Or force that employee into a situation where they have to decide whether or not they want to do that?
I'm thinking. Through the chair, Senator Elton, I believe that would be possible, because if an employer terminated now, they would first have to pay their termination costs and close out their account before they can rejoin. If they rejoin, they are a DCR member. So if they have any DB employees working for them, those DB employees would participate in the DCR plan. At the time they terminate, any non-vested defined benefit members they have the option to become vested in the defined benefit plan.
If I can follow up, Mr. Chair.
Just could you, and I'll let you follow up. Could you make it more on point on health insurance, the healthcare cost under your example? Or you can always get back to us later with this. It's kind of a technical question that Senator Ellen's asking.
Well, as the health costs are related, the defined benefit member who becomes vested at the time the employer terminates, if they're tier one or two, they would become vested in the health costs at that, or the health plan, the DB health plan at that time. If they are tier three, they would have to have 10 years of service in order to be eligible for the defined benefit medical plan. So when they begin participation as a DCR plan, some of them will earn a medical entitlement from the DCR plan as well as the defined benefit plan.
Go ahead and follow up with your question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Kathy, what would the termination cost be to a small community that has one, two, or three employees? What would the termination cost be to a community that is only paying the normal cost? You had mentioned that there would need to be an actuarial review. I mean, how much would that typically cost if in fact a community did decide that they wanted to terminate from the plan and then rejoin as a defined contribution employer?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, each employer, their costs are individual depending on the number of retirees they have, the number of active members they have, the age of those members, the amount of service they have. What we could do is probably give you some sample costs, but I would not feel comfortable giving you a blanket range at this point.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm assuming that there would be a cost, but would there be a situation in which a small community might get a payment from the state after they terminate?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think we'd need to
Thanks.
Look into
Thanks,
it.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Let me add a little bit to that. There are a few, because what we're talking about here is the municipalities and the cities. The other entities are the state and the university, so they don't count in the conversation here on this question. There are some communities, mostly very small communities, villages, that are in a premium, or they have a surplus, not a deficit. Depending on the size of the surplus, that, you know, could be an issue they face. But regardless of that, they're still on the hook for the benefits in perpetuity to the employees. There isn't, at least it doesn't appear to me, that we're in a position like some corporate entities where the pension plan is very rich, where they liquidate the company to access the benefits of the surplus in the pension plan. We're running substantial deficits. The other issue is if a community decides to opt out, for instance, I'll use Petersburg because it's in my district, if they decide to opt out, they can do that and start their own defined benefit plan if they want to. But I think if a community was to opt out of the defined benefit plan and then try to re-engage with the state to push everybody that's currently employed under these different tiers into the DC plan, that's not the intent of what we've worked on here for a few years, and I think we would block that maneuver. I mean, that's not fair play.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I would agree with that it's not fair play. I just think that we need to be careful to make sure that under the language of this bill, that they know that they can't do that rather than us reacting to them at some point in the future.
We have other questions on this bill? Senator Huggins.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the case of employers allowing people to go, an employee to go from defined benefit to defined contribution, that's an election that the employer has to make to be able to facilitate that. Is that correct? To date, how many employers have made that election, roughly speaking?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, three.
Three. And which would they be?
The state of Alaska, Bering Strait School. We do have one other employer that has contacted us for information. They have not yet joined.
Right. And is that an issue amongst employees, or are we hearing complaints that my employer will not allow me to?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, we have not received any employee complaints that their employer is not allowing the conversion.
Right. Assume for a moment that I am an employee in one of the three, and I decide to go from defined benefit to defined contribution. Is there a charge to me for doing that?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, no, there's no charge to you. What you do is you will roll over the balance of your employee contribution account to the defined contribution plan. In doing so, you forfeit all your rights in the defined benefit plan, and your employer will match your contribution account balance 100%.
Okay, thank you.
Could you elaborate on that last part of the sentence? Because when your employer has to match the funds or whatever fund value is put on it, the defined benefit plan into the new defined contribution plan, there's an issue with accessing the trust versus the general account of the particular entity involved. And can you elaborate on it?
Yes, Senator Stedman. The employer has to match the account with new money. They cannot use any of the assets that they have in the defined benefit plan to match the employee account. So whatever contributions they have made on behalf of that employee remain in the defined benefit account. That's one of the reasons why this bill places a limit on the length of time the election is afforded to the employee, because if it's open-ended, it's very difficult for employers to budget and estimate for that new cost if their employees can for years make that election. So by limiting it to 12 months, it assists the employers and we hope will make it more attractive for them.
And could you please go over who's eligible for the conversion?
Any non-vested employee is eligible for the conversion, and they have up until either they vest or 1 year from the date the option is allowed by their employer to convert.
So the targeted group here is tier three, is that correct?
We have had some tier two who are not vested, but the targeted group is tier three.
Okay. Do we have any other questions today? Senator L.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a busy mind. And given the scenario that the chair did using Petersburg, and I don't feel comfortable using Petersburg, so I'll use Juneau. I mean, if Juneau decides not to become to remove themselves as a PERS employer, and then at some point decides now they want to become a PERS employer again and convert everybody to a DCR. I mean, how do you assess? How do you assess how much Juneau owes, given the fact that we don't identify by PERS employer what their individual liabilities are?
I think this is a question that might be better answered by our Chief Financial Officer, Charlene Morrison.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator Elton, I'll just go back to the accounting issues presentation that we gave. And Charlene, I know we'll come and explain it verbally, but I think going back to looking at that accounting issues slide presentation, she talks specifically about how that accounting liability is assessed. And I know for me, it's easier for me to have that slide in front of me when Charlene has given me the explanation of how that accounting works.
Well, I mean, if you could identify yourself for the record and
Thank you. My name is Charlene Morrison, and I am the Chief Financial Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. I can tell you what we've done in the past as far as terminations is, first, when an employer chooses to terminate, they file paperwork with the division. We then send a letter out to all of the non-vested employees and give them an option to either vest or refund. So we need that information before we can ask the actuary to calculate for us what the termination cost is. Once we have all that information back, we send data to the actuary and have the actuary calculate a termination liability. So we could have someone who only has 1 year of service in who has chosen to vest, and if they're a tier one person, they actually vest in the health care, which is a very expensive benefit, as well as in their pension. So the actuary will calculate as best they can what that termination cost would be. Then we use that termination study, provide it to the community, compare their termination liability with the assets that they have in the system. And when I went through the accounting issues, there are accounting concerns with regards to those assets. And the difference is the termination cost to the employer. I think that that would have to be looked at closely going forward.
Can I just add a little bit? I think I recognize the concern that Senator Elton has as far as kind of gaming or manipulating the system, and clearly we don't want to have that go on where someone terminates a plan to force everybody into the new plan and so on and so forth. But one of the other things we have on the table before us the next couple of months working on is the sharing of the unfunded liability that the municipalities are faced with. And there's hundreds of millions of dollars. And it appears that the legislature is going forward with some kind of a sharing mechanism to help the municipalities pay that liability, if it's Juneau or Sitka or Bethel or whoever. I guess Bethel's in premium. But if you were to terminate your plan, like Sitka, for instance, is running a deficit, they've got an unfunded liability. If they terminate their plan, they would have to deal with that unfunded liability with no help from the state. And clearly that is a huge carrot to well, let me rephrase that, not a carrot. It is a financial obstacle for termination of the plan when the state is going to step in and do some form of help in funding the unfunded liability. I don't think it would make a practical reason to terminate that plan and be hit with. I think that's we're at tens of millions of dollars in all our communities, depending on the size. I don't have the list in front of me. We can all look up the liabilities. But to have that liability all come due in one day would be a choker. But I recognize where you're going, Senator Elden. We'll take a look at that to see that we have some kind of a balance here, so we don't ever get in a position where a municipality may do that mechanism, at least come back to the state if they want to opt out and do it themselves. I suppose that's another matter, but to come back into the state plan.
Mr. Chair, I recognize what you're saying, and I agree. I think the sticking point might come from the discussion that we've had about not being able to allocate liabilities by PERS employer, and so there could easily be a lot of argument over what the terminating PERS employer liability actually may be, and the state may have a difficult time countering those arguments.
Senator Thomas, you look like you're just dying to ask a question this morning.
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 19, the administrative section, bullet 2 says, remove Social Security tax wage base cap from employee-employer contributions. Could you explain a little to me why that was done? What was the reasoning?
I'd be happy to. Through the chair, Senator Thomas, Senate Bill 141, in its definition of compensation, indicated that the compensation for members in this plan is subject to just their wages up to the Social Security wage base. What this new bill does is removes that limitation so that contributions can be made into this plan by both the employer and the employee on all of the wages made by that employee and not limit them by the Social Security wage base. So more contributions would be going into the employee's account with the passage of this bill.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
I have put a flag on that one myself, Senator Thomas. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. As the supervisor of this program, per se, excuse the term, do you have any concerns about employers terminating the program?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I'm going to defer. I've been the administrator of this program for 2 months. I don't have enough history to be able to adequately answer that question. I don't know if Charlene, in a year of experience, knows or not, but she'd be better to answer.
Through the chair, Senator Higgins, I think it's a right of the employer. You know, I think it's prudent that we provide that option to the employer if they so choose. The employer would then need to come up with their own benefit plan outside of the one that they might be participating in now. But I do think it's an important option that should be available to participating employers in the public employees retirement system.
Yeah, I understand option. My question is whether or not that you think that practically is going to happen either in small numbers or large numbers.
Practically, I have to say I share the comments made by the chair. For the employers who have been in the plan for many years, it may be too much of a financial burden to remove themselves from the plan now. Some of the smaller employers who have not participated in the plan for many years may find that more appealing. I can't say that I'm concerned one way or the other for the plan.
And finally, Mr. Chair, if I might, the potential for not being able to fix what the liability of an employer would be based on, some accounting difficulties we have, is that a huge concern of yours? Should I be concerned about it and lay awake at night as I look at the ceiling, or what should I be thinking?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I'll say I don't lay awake at night worrying about it. Other people might, but what I think we have to do is go forward. We know what's happened in the last 20 years, and like I've said to Senator Alton, I'm the new commissioner and I'm here to help. I do want you to understand that what we're doing is looking at this, looking at every aspect of the plan while we have this technical bill out here and seeing what changes we need to do to make it very clear how the plan is to be structured.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Elton.
Thanks. New topic, and it's a question that I hadn't thought of. I mean, some defined benefit employees have been known to cash out, to leave state service for a short period of time so that they can cash out their SBS. One of the examples that somebody has used is that they do that perhaps to accommodate a divorce settlement. They need to cash out their SBS. So if they do that under the recipe that is proposed, they would cash out, get their SBS, or they'd cash out their SBS, come back to state service, and they'd come back to state service as a defined contribution employee at that point. Is that that's my assumption?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, no. If they cash out their SBS and leave their defined benefit contributions in the plan, they still are a defined benefit member and would return as a defined benefit member. It's only if they cash out their defined benefit contributions and don't reinstate their employment with a covered employer by July 1st, 2010, that they would lose that tier. But not the SBS.
A follow-up. Would that option be available to them after 2010?
The option to cash out?
Yeah, to cash out their SBS.
Yeah, I believe the options do not change after 2010. It's just being able to buy back the defined benefit service.
That
they
changes.
Don't reinstate,
okay.
That changes great. After 2010.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe you could take the opportunity to elaborate a little bit on the qualified domestic orders on when there's a separation between a husband and wife and one of them is an employee of the or a beneficiary of the plan. I don't think the judge forces you to terminate, but there's quite a bit of authority within one of those for the assets to be split up short of having to separate from service to do that. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, that's one I can't elaborate on. I'd be happy to turn it back over to Kathy Lee because I know she knows about that. So let me turn it over to her.
Senator Stedman, in answer to your question, in a qualified domestic relations order, the member is not required to terminate. Basically, what the order does is it assigns a portion of their accounts, whether it is a supplemental benefit system account, a defined benefit account, or the new DCR account, to their former spouse. Now, under the supplemental benefit system and the defined contribution retirement accounts, since those are individual monetary accounts, what happens is a separate account is created for the former spouse. And the monies based on the order that have been determined to be the property of that former spouse are moved into that account. So they actually establish their own account. Under the defined benefit plan, we normally do not see a qualified domestic relations order that splits the contribution account. It splits the retirement benefit and any future medical benefits, depending on whether the divorce is before or after retirement.
Thank you. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a little bit of a follow-up on the question I asked before regarding the Social Security cap. Does this not allowing us to rise to whatever the employee's salary is, does that create a further disparity between the participating employers potentially, or do we figure that since it's a no account system with based on percentages that it really doesn't make any difference?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I don't believe it creates any disparity. Basically, this provision applied to the supplemental benefits annuity program, which is the state's replacement for Social Security, and that's why the Social Security wage cap was included in that language. It should not have been included in the defined contribution retirement plans because there's no need for it. So I don't believe it creates a disparity amongst the employers because each employee receives the same percentage of their salary that goes into the account.
Okay, thank you.
Do we have any other questions this morning? Then we'll take a brief at ease here and then wrap up. Okay, we'll come back on the record just for wrap up. This wraps up the agenda. It's a one-item agenda today. So pretty hard to get confused on what's on the agenda, but tomorrow we'll be back at 9 a.m. We're going to continue work on SB 125, which is the cost share. We'll have some call-in testimony. We'll have the administration here to answer questions. We'll just kind of work through that bill depending on the flow. So I have no time frame on it to give you. We just got to work on it until we get it done. We're also going to hear Senate Bill 97 dealing with the Alaska Native Art Identification Seal. We'll try to wrap that bill up tomorrow. So thanks, everybody, for coming, and we'll see you tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Meeting adjourned.